Well, tonight we continue our series on the existence of God. And as I've said all along, we're following the outline of Stephen Charnock in his, at the beginning of his volumes on the existence and attributes of God. Stephen Charnock died in 1680. He lived during the glorious 17th century in which Christian scientists dominated the early scientific revolution. And the watchword of the day was intelligibility by the scientists. And their view was that God is the author of all things. He created all things. He is intelligent. He has a mind. And he has all wisdom and all knowledge and all power, and he designed everything the way he wanted it. And in the beginning, it was all very good. And it is our sin that has actually created the monkey wrench to introduce all of the futility that we're used to for disease, cancer, deformities. Talk a little bit about that too as well. But tonight we start a new section of his argument. You remember at the very beginning, he introduced this topic of the existence of God by Psalm 14, verse 1. That the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And in Hebrew, it's Elohim. That the fool has said in his heart, there is no Elohim. That there is no judge or ruler over me. And Charnock's main arguments, the first one was that it is foolish to deny what all men manifest. And it's the argument from universal consent. And we looked at that. That no matter where you go and to study in the history of humanity, every group of people, every tribe has been religious, which is evidence for the existence of God. That every group of people has acknowledged that there is a supreme being that deserves to be worshipped. His second argument, I think the longest in his argumentation, is that it is foolish to deny what all creatures manifest. That's the second one. It is foolish to deny what all creatures manifest in their production, in their order and harmony, in their ends, and in their preservation. Both encompassing the teleological argument for the existence of God and the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Teleological from purposes and designs, and cosmological from arguing from effect back to cause. Well, number three here is it is foolish to deny what a man's own nature witnesses to him. We've talked a little bit about the systems of the human body under order and harmony. All of these different arguments can be distinguished but never separated. And that's why there's always overlap, that you see it when you read him. And he'll even mention about irreducible complexity, which is an argument from harmony and systems in this section. So he brings it back in terms of focusing those solely upon our human bodies. We know Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, where it gives us a detailed description of how God created man. So you have this record in Genesis chapter 1 of all the 6 days of creation. Man created on the sixth day, God rests the seventh day, declared it hallowed. And then in the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, there's a rehearsal then of more explanation of what occurred when God created man. And Genesis chapter 2, verse 7 says that God formed man of dust of the earth and breathed into him the breath of life, and man became a living being. And that verse says that human beings have two parts. That God formed man of dust of the earth. We have a physical body. And God breathed into him the breath of life. That we have a soul, a non-material part. Sometimes the soul is called spirit. So we're two parts. Sometimes referred to body and soul. Sometimes referred to as body and spirit. A physical part, the body, and a non-physical part, the spirit. And what he's going to do in his argument is look at the human body, and then he's going to look at the soul. We live in a day and age right now that, as Francis Schaeffer put it, when I was a young boy, modern man views human beings as mere physical machines. That's all we are, is a body. And there's great problems with that. For one, we're no longer free beings, free agents. If we're only a physical being, then our choices are nothing but physical reactions caused by what you eat for breakfast, for example. And that's where Francis Schaeffer would say it's a form of determinism, that we're always determined by something physical. Yeah, and we're gonna talk about the brain tonight as well. Pastor Ron's point, if you didn't grab it, is that modern man, if it views you and me as solely and only physical beings, then if we have some strange behavior, something that's not right, then to them, we're only a physical being, so therefore it must be some chemical issue, and therefore the solution is a drug. Always a drug. A physical solution. Change the chemistry of your body some way or another. Now, we are body and spirit, and therefore some of our problems are physical. They are. The power of a lie is its closeness to the truth. You can drink enough coffee to make your hands jittery. It'll affect your heart rate. It'll affect you. But we are more than just a body. We're also spirit. Stephen Charnock said this, I put this quote on the board here, "A body framed with an admirable architecture, a soul endowed with understanding, will, judgment, memory, imagination," unquote. Now, the soul, in the Christian worldview, the soul or spirit of man is mind is a part of it. This is his understanding. This is where we do not view the brain, the physical brain we have, that we're going to talk about, as identical or a synonym with the mind. We do not. That's the way modern man looks at us. To modern man, we're only a physical being. So when they speak of our mind, they're speaking essentially of the brain, a physical entity. But from the Christian worldview perspective, notice how Stephen Charnock phrased this. The mind, or the understanding, the mind is a part of the soul, the non-physical part of us, the spirit. The will is the mind choosing. We make certain judgments about things with our mind. There's memory that our mind has. We can imagine things with our minds. But this is a part of the soul, part of the spirit, something non-physical, part of who we are. Now, they interact. They interact with one another too, interestingly enough. Who had a pretty good headache a week ago during our Bible study? Well, that affects his, how clearly he thinks at the same time. Okay, it's harder to think. If you've had a very bad headache or toothache, it can be hard to focus. Physical pain affects your spirit, your mind. It's a fact. Two parts. I'll read it again. A body framed with an admirable architecture, a soul endowed with understanding, will, judgment, memory, imagination. So the body framed with an admirable architecture. This adjective, admirable, that it's something to be admired. To sit back and wonder at it. Okay? We're going to do a little bit of that tonight. I brought my anatomy and physiology textbook again from college. So that's what we'll be looking at tonight is the body, and then moving into the next time we meet the soul. But the design and structure displays of our body, the design and structure of who we are, body and soul, displays God's infinite power and wisdom. Remember, wisdom is what's fitting, to know what's fitting under all circumstances, the best means to achieve certain ends, and how all these different pieces fit together. Charnock, another quote by Charnock, so we need not step out of doors or cast our eyes any further than ourselves to behold a God who made us. He, as you know, his last main section was, it is foolish to deny what all creatures manifest. And there our eyes have gazed out upon creation. Psalm 19, 1 and following. Romans 1, 20. The heavens declare the work of God, and their expanse the work of his hands. Day to day brings forth speech, night to night reveals knowledge. Psalm 19, 1 and following. Romans 1, 20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that men are without excuse. But there our eyes have gone out and looked out at the rocks and the trees, the sun and the solar system, all of the various animals and creatures God has created, and the birds. And this main argument now we're under Charnock is to say, you really need no look further than yourself. For evidence for the existence of God. We're a walking exhibit, admissible in a courtroom, for the existence of God, each one of us. Each one of us is a walking exhibit that's admissible in a court of law for evidence of the existence of God. So, a subheading under this. Number one, in the parts whereof man does consist, body and soul. And we're going to look at the body. Okay? So first, the human body. But turn to Psalm 139. Turn to Psalm 139. We'll read here verses 13 through 16. Psalm 139, verses 13 through 16. Hear now the words of God. David says to God, "For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well." See where the mind is? It's in the soul. "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them." David says, "I will praise you," in verse 14, "for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works." Essentially, Charnock's point is that all such considerations should be a matter of praise to God. When we're considering the various parts of who we are, body and soul, and our consideration of it, thinking about it, what are we doing? We're thinking about the very works of God. What is praise? We've said it many times. Praise is extolling or proclaiming who God is, extolling or proclaiming His works, what He's done, and then thanking Him both for who He is and what He's done. And here, a consideration, we're pondering the very works of God. Who He is, His skill, His wisdom, His power, and how He fashioned us and formed us, and how we're fearfully and wonderfully made. So the human body, that's what we're looking at here. Charnock says this, "All the sinews, all the connections, the veins, arteries, bones, like a piece of embroidery or tapestry, were wrought by God, as it were, with deliberation." Unquote. All the sinews, veins, arteries, bones, like a piece of embroidery or tapestry, were wrought by God, as it were, with deliberation. Unquote. Veins, say, what are veins? Veins carry blood to the heart. Arteries carry blood away from the heart, part of the cardiovascular system. Bones, part of the skeletal system. About 20% of your body weight is bones, part of your skeletal system. So if you're 160 pounds, about 30 pounds of you is your skeletal system, your bones. And it's begin to think of the embroidery. You seen a wonderful embroidery that's been done? I got one hanging up at home. There's a couple of hanging up at home from grandma's. They shows great skill embroidery. Charnock, quote, the artificial structure of it, the elegancy of every part, the proper situation of them, their proportion one to another, and their fitness for their several functions. All part of this wonderful embroidery. So he's going to want us to consider several things, okay? This big book's so heavy, it's my podium won't even hold it. isn't that interesting? Okay, I'll have to hold it. Now, if you remember, the human body, we have 11 systems in the human body, and I want to read a little bit from this book. What I did is I sat down last night, and I went through, and I thought, we need to consider how we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And part of it is to begin, we don't have it unless we read some details, okay? So tonight is a little bit of a human anatomy and physiology class as we ponder and consider the works of God who made us, okay? I want to read a little bit about blood vessels here as we think about veins and arteries, the cardiovascular system. That's what we're dealing with veins and arteries, dealing with blood vessels. All of our understanding of this goes back to a scientist called William Harvey. He died in 1657. He was a Christian. He was a part of the early scientific revolution in England, especially. If you think in your mind, rationalism primarily dominated France. Empiricism dominated England, okay, the early Enlightenment period. Empiricism, being empirical is being scientific, okay, gaining knowledge by our five senses. That's what dominated England, and that's why when you've got John Ray, the early botanist, biologist in the early 1600s, English. Sir Robert, he was the founder of botany and biology, basically, John Ray. Sir Robert Boyle, chemist in England, founder of modern chemistry, Christian in the 1600s in England. But you've got Galileo with Italy. You've got Johannes Kepler with astronomy. Both of those guys, Galileo and Johannes Kepler, Christians, but with astronomy. Well, this guy here, William Harvey, was an English physician. And I want to read a little bit. This is from, I have an article here, Christianity Today, and they had published for a while, no longer do they do it, but Christian History, they had a publication with that. I have an article from 2002 that they had on William Harvey. Okay, but this is from the secular, atheistic, Darwinian, human anatomy and physiology textbook that I took at Southwest State University. In the University of Minnesota system back in the 90s. Here's what it says on blood vessels. The blood vessels of the body, this is not a Christian publication, okay, just to be clear. The blood vessels of the body form a closed delivery system that begins and ends at the heart. The idea that blood circulates in the body dates back to the 1620s to the inspired experiments of William Harvey, an English physician. Prior to that time, it was thought, as proposed by the ancient Greek physician Galen, and that's roughly in the 2nd century B.C. is him, Galen. So from the 2nd century B.C. all the way up to the 1620s A.D., it was thought that blood moved through the body like an ocean tide, first moving out from the heart and then ebbing back into the heart via the same vessels, being the same vessels. Remember I said here, veins carry blood to the heart, and arteries carry blood away from the heart. A different one carries to, a different one carries away. But the idea was that the same ones, it just ebbs out and ebbs back in the same vessels. Although blood vessels are often compared to a system of plumbing pipes within which blood circulates, this analogy serves only as a starting point. Unlike rigid pipes, blood vessels are dynamic structures that pulsate, constrict, and relax, and even proliferate as demanded by the changing needs of the body. Altogether, the blood vessels in the adult human body carry blood on a journey that stretches for about 60,000 miles through the internal body landscape. Through my body, my blood vessels transport blood approximately 60,000 miles with all of the various things that are in my body through which that blood will flow. Would you say that the tapestry and the embroidery is pretty fine? I'll read it again. The blood vessels in the adult human body carry blood on a journey that stretches for about 60,000 miles through the internal body landscape. And they have it with an exclamation point. Let me read just a little bit about William Harvey here. William Harvey died 1657, founded the science of physiology by revolutionizing ideas in the movement of the heart and blood that had prevailed since Galen in the 2nd century B.C. Harvey not only discovered that blood circulates and learned the true purpose of the venous valves and the heart's motion, but he also contributed to embryology and strongly influenced the next generation of medical researchers, setting the stage for modern medical science. The London physician did this while acting as the resident doctor for the poor at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, a lecturer at the College of Physicians, a private practitioner, and later court physician to King James I, and the personal physician to King Charles I. Harvey was influenced by the Calvinist environment of Cambridge, and indeed the Church of England, during his student years. His tutor at Cambridge, George Estey, was a clergyman, pastor, and lecturer in Hebrew. Throughout his written works, Harvey reinterpreted the classical principle, quote, "Nature does nothing in vain," unquote, as a statement of God's sovereign purposefulness in creating and sustaining the natural world, as reflected in Isaiah 45:18. In his one book, Exercises on the Generation of Animals, in 1651, for example, Harvey praised the workings of God's sovereignty in creation, which he termed nature. And the theme is the book's title there of destines, ordains, and it goes into intends, gives gifts, provides, counterbalances, institutes, and is careful. His various words for all of the purposes and designs evidenced in creation. Harvey told a friend, quote, "The examination of the bodies of animals has always been my delight, and I have thought that we might thence not only obtain an insight into the mysteries of nature or creation, but there perceive a kind of image or reflection of the omnipotent Creator Himself." As Johannes Kepler said when he studied nature, creation, he said, "We're thinking God's thoughts after Him." It was this keen sense of divine purpose that led Harvey to his momentous discovery of blood circulation. Having realized that the tiny valves in our veins allow blood to flow only one way, Harvey struggled to determine God's purpose in their construction. As he considered the size of the arteries and the position and the undirectionality of the veins' valves, he concluded that the blood does not move back and forth in the veins and arteries as once thought. Rather, it moves in a life-sustaining circuit, flowing out from the heart into the arteries and then returning through the veins. Echoing Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11 and 14, Harvey concluded, quote, "Life therefore resides in the blood, as we are informed in our sacred writings," unquote. The skeletal system, let me read a little bit on that. Give you a little flavor of the tapestry here in this. I'll read from the Anatomy and Physiology book that's written from a Darwinian perspective. Now get a load of this one. I really like this one. The word skeleton comes from the Greek word meaning dried up body or mummy. A rather unflattering description. Now listen carefully. Nonetheless, the internal human framework is a triumph of design and engineering that puts any skyscraper to shame. It is strong yet light and is almost perfectly adapted for the protective, locomotor, and manipulative functions it performs. I want to read that phrase again. The internal human framework of our skeletal system is a triumph of design and engineering that puts any skyscraper to shame. It's light and yet strong and mobile and aids in our movement. And the very next paragraph is how over millions of years it came about by chance. Our skeletal's present form was shaped more than 3 million years ago when ancestors of human beings first stood erect on hind legs. You can't... They're talking out of both sides of their mouth, right? It's a contradiction. Again, we've said clearly, Darwinian evolution, which today is neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory, is genetics, based on genetics. But it's time, chance, struggle, and death. Time, chance, struggle, and death. They're the four elements of Darwinian evolutionary theory. Chance is the main element. Randomness. No designer, no architect, no intelligence. Just random chance. Throwing things up and whatever happens, happens. And this again, Douglas Wilson's critique of the God delusion by Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins tried to say, people like to say there's just design or chance. And Richard Dawkins, a leading scientist in the world who's an atheist, tried to say, no, there's a third option, and it's called natural selection. That is a sleight of hand by a liar and a deceiver. As Douglas Wilson said, you either are going to eat cereal or eggs for breakfast. Make your choice. And the guy looks and says, I want an omelet. If you've said you want an omelet, then you're saying you want eggs, because you don't get an omelet unless you have eggs. Right? That's what Richard Dawkins has done. You're all going to either have design that brought about this world, or it all came about by chance. It's one or the other. What do you want? And Richard Dawkins says, I don't want either. I want a third, natural selection. Well, you don't get natural selection unless you have chance. But it is. I agree with their wonderful paragraph that the internal human framework of our skeletal system is a triumph of design and engineering that puts any skyscraper to shame. We glory in God's wisdom and power and goodness in what He has done. It is strong yet light and is almost perfectly adapted for the protective, locomotor, and manipulative functions it performs. By the way, there are 206 named bones in the human skeletal system, composed of bones, cartilages, joints, and ligaments, all the things that are connected together. So under this A down here, he says, consider the order, fitness, and usefulness of the body parts. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about veins and arteries there and bones. Here's what Charnock does. Charnock mentions irreducible complexity. This is a direct quote. Remember, he died in 1680. This is a big argument. You remember from Darwin's Black Box. If you ever get a chance, read Darwin's Black Box by Dr. Michael Behe. B-E-H-E. B-E-H-E. You can get it cheap, used through Amazon if you sought it out. But because it's all about irreducible complexity at the biochemical level in the human body. But Charnock mentions irreducible complexity. He says this, quote, take but one part away in the human body. In the human body, take but one part away, and you either destroy the whole or stamp upon it some mark of deformity, unquote. It's a shade of irreducible complexity. We have many parts that if you take away, you destroy the whole. Remove my brain, I'm done. Remove my heart, I'm done. Remove my pancreas, I'm done. Right? There's many organs you remove from us, we're done. Okay? Or you remove a part from us, and that's where we call ourselves deformed. Cut off my hand, I'm deformed. Lose an eye, I'm deformed. So he's got several ones to ponder here. The heart. Charnock says this, how strongly it is guarded with ribs like a wall, that it might not be easily hurt. Gloria had her accident, right, on her bike, her motorized bike, between here and New London, here in Spicer, and cracked some ribs. Our rib cage guards our heart. I want to read a little bit about the heart here. Hang on. It's a wonderful design, isn't it? Heart's pretty important. I want to read just a little bit here about it pumping. You know, you don't even think about it, right? It just beep, 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 keeps pumping blood, right? It just keeps pumping blood. Cardiac output, called CO, cardiac output is the amount of blood pumped out by each ventricle in 1 minute. In 1 minute's time, how much blood is pumped out by each ventricle of the heart? It's the product of your heart rate and the stroke volume. Heart rate, how much is beating, and the stroke volume. Stroke volume is the volume of blood pumped out by a ventricle with each beat. With each beat, beep, 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 how much blood is pumped. Okay? In general, the stroke volume is correlated with force of ventricular contraction. Using the normal resting values for heart rate, 75 beats per minute, and a stroke volume of 7 milliliters per beat, the average adult cardiac output can easily be computed of 5.25 liters per minute. So when 1 minute goes by, your heart has pumped 5.25 liters of blood. What's so fascinating about that? The normal adult blood volume is about 5 liters. A complete circulation of your blood in about a minute, on average. Thus, the entire blood supply passes through each side of the heart once each minute, on average. And in our cardiovascular system, it's carrying oxygen, the blood's carrying nutrients, carrying waste, and a whole bunch of other products circulating through your body that you need when your cardiovascular system is connected with all your 10 other systems in your body. We have 11 systems. Charnock speaks of the mouth and the human digestive system. You know, when my throat got fried by COVID and I ended up at Rochester, the Mayo Clinic down in Rochester, I ended up with a gastroenterologist who was dealing with a specialist in digestion when my throat got fried. Because everything from the mouth all the way down through the stomach, esophagus, down to the stomach, and then through the intestines, all of it is part of the digestive system, another whole system of the body. I'm going to read a little bit on the mouth here. Pastor Ron studied that fairly extensively. Obviously, he was a dentist. The mouth is what it's got in the anatomy and physiology textbook here. The mouth is the only part of the alimentary canal involved in ingestion or food entry in the body. However, most digestive functions associated with mouth reflect the activity of the related accessory organs, such as the teeth, the salivary glands, the tongue, because within the mouth, food is chewed and mixed and moistened with saliva containing enzymes that begin the process of chemical digestion. The mouth also begins the propulsive process of swallowing, during which food is carried through the pharynx and esophagus to the stomach. The brain, fortified by a strong skull, that's what Charnock says, fortified by a strong skull to hinder outward accidents. Read a little bit on that. Part of the central nervous system with the brain, connected to the spinal cord and all of the sense. When you feel something, right? Your eyes sense something, takes things in. We're going to talk about the eyes a little bit too. With vision or with feel or all of this stuff with our senses goes to the central nervous system and then transported up to the brain. Where then the mind and our soul is figuring things out, right? Assessing it. This is the way they introduce the brain. You are driving down the freeway and a horn blares to your right. You swerve to your left. Charlie leaves a note on the kitchen table. See you later. Have the stuff ready at 6. You know that the stuff is chilly with taco chips. You are dozing and your infant son makes a soft cry. Instantly you awaken. What do all these events have in common? They are all everyday examples of the functioning of your central nervous system, which has your body cells humming with activity nearly all the time. The nervous system is the master controlling and communicating system of the body. Every thought, action, and emotion reflects its activity in the central nervous system. We would say more with the mind and the understanding of the soul, right? But it interacts somehow with the brain. Along with the endocrine system, it is responsible for regulating and maintaining body homeostasis. What's your temperature right now? Of the two systems, it is by far more rapid, acting, and complex. Cells of the central nervous system communicate by means of electrical signals, which are rapid, specific, and usually cause immediate responses. The central nervous system has three overlapping functions. It uses its millions of sensory receptors to monitor changes occurring both inside and outside the body. And these changes are called stimuli, and the gathered information is called sensory input. You get a response from certain sensory input. We call it motor output with your muscles. An example will illustrate how these functions work together. When you are driving and see a red light ahead, sensory input, your nervous system integrates this system. Red light means stop, and your foot goes for the brake, the motor output. How about the ear? Let's go on the ear. Charnock says, the ear is so disposed as to admit sounds with the greatest safety and delight. He refers to Ecclesiastes 12:4. Ecclesiastes 12:4. When the doors are shut in the streets and the sound of grinding is low, when one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of music are brought low. Now that context is verse 1 there of chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come and the years draw near. When I have a hard time hearing, for example, days will come, right, of hearing loss. I want you to think a little bit about the ear and sound. What's real fascinating when you get to the ear, okay? Our ear, the way God created our ear, has three parts. We have an outer part, a middle part, and an inner part, an inner ear. And a lot is with the science of sound itself, with reverberations. We're playing the piano tonight. Reverberations. Crazy stuff with think about this, okay? Because we'll get with the eye in a minute here. Unlike light, which can be transmitted through a vacuum, for instance, like outer space, Sound depends on an elastic medium for its transmission. Sound also travels much more slowly than light. Its speed in dry air is only about 0.2 miles per second, as opposed to 186,000 miles per second for light. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second, but sound in dry air is only 0.2 miles per second. Much slower. A lightning flash is almost instantly visible, but the sound it creates, the thunder, reaches our ears much more slowly. For each second between the lightning bolt and the roll of thunder, the sound, the storm is 1/5 of a mile farther away for each second. So if it takes 5 seconds, it's a mile away for you to hear the thunder after you see it, the lightning. The speed of sound is constant in a given medium, but it is greatest in solids and lowest in gases, including air. Now, why is this all important? Because he who designed our ears had to know all the physics of all of this. How is sound going to hit your ear and cause vibrations so that you're going to begin to know what you're hearing and then transport it to your central nervous system, to your brain, and that your mind can understand? Sound is a pressure disturbance originating from a vibrating object and propagated by the molecules of the medium. And they go to a tuning fork. A tuning fork works with the vibrations. Think about this. With frequency, a pure tone, and it says it's periodic. That is, it crests and troughs repeat at different distances. The distance between two consecutive crests or troughs is called the wavelength of the sound and is constant for a particular tone. Frequency, expressed in hertz, is defined as the number of waves that pass a given point in a given time. The shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency of the sound. The frequency range of human hearing is from 20 to 20,000 hertz. Our ears are most sensitive to frequencies between 1,500 and 4,000 hertz, and in that range we can distinguish frequencies differing by only 2 to 3 hertz. Very precise. We perceive different sound frequencies as differences in pitch. The higher the frequency, the higher the pitch. And that's where a tuning fork then produces a tone, a pure but bland sound with a single frequency. But most sounds are mixtures of several frequencies. That's why when they're going to use a tuning fork to tune something, so they get one single frequency. But it is this characteristic of sound called quality that enables us to distinguish between the same musical note, say a high C, sung by a soprano and played on a piano or a clarinet. The quality. You can see that single frequency, no matter what it's played by or sung by. It is the quality of sound that provides the richness and complexity of sounds and music that we hear, as well as the sound input we call noise. And then it gets to amplification and loudness. We can hear an enormous range of intensities, from the proverbial pin drop to a steam whistle 100 trillion times as loud as a pin drop. Sound intensity and loudness is measured in logarithmic units called decibels. Logarithmic units means it's logarithmic, so it exponentially increases as the decibels go up. A sound of 10 decibels has 10 times more energy than one of 0 decibels. And a 20 decibel sound has 100 times more energy. See, it's this exponential increase of energy. The healthy adult ear can pick up differences in sound intensity as small as 0.1 decibel, and the normal range of hearing, from barely audible to the loudest sound we can process without excruciating pain, extends over a range of 120 decibels, and the threshold of pain is 130 decibels. Severe hearing loss occurs with frequent or prolonged exposure to sounds with intensities greater than 90 decibels. Hearing occurs when the auditory area of the temporal lobe cortex is stimulated inside our ear. However, before this can happen, sound waves must be propagated through air, bone, fluids to reach and stimulate the receptor cells in the organ of corti. And this, all the physics involved to go from through air, through bone, and through fluids to get to stimulate a certain thing God put in our ear to register the waves and the frequencies. And there are certain inner hair cells that are there in the inner ear. It's astounding, the actual complexity of it all with the physics. In addition to balance, connected with our ears, the eye, Charnock says this, quote, both the eyes seated in the hollow of the bone for security, just like he said, the heart organ is protected in the ribs. The eyes are seated in the hollow of the bone of our skull for security, yet standing out that things may be perceived more easily on both sides, unquote. So they stick out a little bit so that we have depth perception, right? See out of the peripheral when we're driving the car, and we can see what's going on the beside the road as well at the same time. Let me read just a little bit on the eye. Think about this. This is fascinating. Of all the sensory receptors in the body, so in your human body, think of all the sensory receptors you have to sense things through the five senses. The eyes are special, and that's where you think of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. This is what it says. Of all the sensory receptors in the human body, 70% are in the eyes. 70% are in the eyes. Of all the sensory receptors in the whole human body. The photoreceptors sense and encode the patterns made by light in our surroundings. The massive optic tracts that carry the coded information from the eyes to the brain contain over 1 million nerve fibers. Only the corticospinal tracts controlling all our voluntary muscles are larger. Our brain invests the signals from our eyes with meaning, fashioning images in the world around us. We would say the mind does. The adult eye is a sphere with a diameter of about 1 inch. Only the anterior 1/6 of the eye's surface is visible. What we see in one another is only 1/6 of the whole eye. The rest is enclosed and protected by a cushion of fat and the walls of the bony orbit. The fat pad occupies nearly all the orbit, not occupied by the eye itself. The eye is a complex structure, and only a small portion of its tissues are actually involved in photoreception. And there's a lens in the eye with muscles beside that that can move it so it makes it thinner or larger, and then focuses the image to the very back of the cornea. And you can't have blood vessels in this liquid because that would make it blurry. So God designed it with a clear fluid so that the image that goes back is clear. Our eyes have an enzyme as well with the secretions of the fluid that's on it that kills bacteria. Every little thing God designed, had a plan for. Said, oh, there's going to be bacteria too. Let's put an enzyme in your eye, in the human eye too, that prevents infections. Right? You get a lot of dust, right? All this bacteria in the air. You go out on a dirty day outside and the dust is blown. Why don't you get infections in your eye all the time? Because God took care of that. Right? The tongue. This is what Charnock says, the tongue. For speech framed like a musical instrument, the teeth serving for a variety of sounds, the lungs serving for bellows to blow the organs, as it were, unquote. Music, right? With music. And the evolutionary biologists that are Darwinian have no explanation for music. By the way, there's no evolutionary reason for music. None. We know God created music to praise Him. The light to his ears. But I remember hearing once about a rock star who had certain teeth, and it was an abnormality in his teeth, but he never got his teeth worked on. because he was afraid it would change the sound of his voice. So I thought of that when I was reading Charnock here. Our teeth and the way they're shaped affect how we sing and how our voice sounds when we sing. Just read a little bit on the tongue here. The tongue occupies the floor of the mouth and fills most of the oral cavity when the mouth is closed, though it houses most of our taste buds and contains some mucus and serous glands. The tongue is mostly composed of interlacing masses of skeletal muscle fibers, and during chewing, the tongue grips the food and constantly repositions it between the teeth. It has a side note here. Children born with an extremely short lingual frenulum are often referred to as, quote, tongue-tied because of speech distortions that result when movement of the tongue is restricted. Every little part and piece God has designed out of wisdom for different purposes. Charnock says this is the quote, not the least part of the body is made in vain. The hairs of the head have their use as well as are an ornament. The whole symmetry of the body is a ravishing object. Every member has a signature and mark of God and His wisdom. Every part of the human body has a signature and mark of God and His wisdom. And you go start really deep diving into the Human Anatomy and Physiology book under each part, and things are a lot more complex than I've shared tonight. Every part has its mark of God's infinite wisdom. But the human body is a ravishing object, Charnock says. My mind went to Michelangelo's statue of David. Michelangelo, contemporary of Luther and Calvin. But in Italy, one of the best artists in the history of humanity. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the statue of David. When it was on display in England, I think I read once, Queen Elizabeth, during the Elizabethan period, Queen Elizabeth put more like a fig leaf around the loin area of the statue because he's buck naked. But it's a masterpiece of the human body. It's 17 feet tall and more than 12,000 pounds from a single block of marble. And it still resides now in Florence, Italy. My wife saw it once on one of her trips. She had traveled to Europe. Although they were doing work on it, so it was all with scaffolding. So he had clothing on. It's a masterpiece. God designed it. And it just makes you wonder on Adam and Eve. God created them at the beginning. No sin, no deformities, no waste or vanity. Charnock said this, quote, if the body of man is fitted for the service of his soul by an infinite God, the body ought to be ordered for the service of this God and in obedience to Him, unquote. So we're of two parts, body and soul. The higher part is our soul. God is spirit, John 4:24. And they that worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth, right? So there's a sense in which The body, our body is fitted for the service of our soul. Think about it a minute. My soul has my understanding, my will, my judgment, my memory, my imagination, right? Like Charnock said. That's my soul, my non-physical part of who I am. But can I go walk to my car right now, just my soul? No. My soul needs the service of my body, right? For me to do anything, right? And this is this idea. If the body of man is fitted for the service of his soul by an infinite God, the body ought to be ordered for the service of this God and in obedience to Him. In other words, after creating man, Genesis 2, 7, God formed man of dust of the earth and breathed in him the breath of life. Man became a living being. What do you have in Genesis 2, 15, shortly thereafter? That God created a garden. And He placed man in the garden. He said, now cultivate and keep that garden. What's He going to do that with? With His body. With physical labor, with His body. The dignity of physical work and labor with this body, serving the soul. Before the curse of sin. You think of Romans 12, 1 and 2. Famous text. Where I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. 1 Corinthians 6:20, referring to our redemption, but you were bought at a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Two parts. Body and spirit. God cares for this physical body. God gave us the physical body to serve our soul, and we ought to glorify God with it. It's a great contrast to the pagans. We've said it before, that's one of the reasons why the pagans have cremation. After death, they cremate the body. Not much respect for it. They tattoo it all up, mark it up, body piercings and everything. So that was A, to consider. B, consider the admirable difference of the physical features of men. Consider not just the parts of the human body, but the admirable difference of the physical features of men. Charnock says this, this could not be wrought by chance. See, they had the same issue back then, right? Remember, evolutionary theory goes back to the ancient Greeks. It was philosophical. He says, this could not be wrought by chance or be the work of mere nature, since we find never or very rarely, because we have some identical twins now and then, two persons exactly alike. This distinction is a part of the infinite wisdom of God. Otherwise, what confusion would be introduced into the world? I'll read it again. This could not be wrought by chance or be the work of mere nature, since we find never or very rarely two persons exactly alike. This distinction is a part of infinite wisdom. Otherwise, what confusion would be introduced into the world? Unquote. if we all looked alike. And I put here, do you remember the Disney movie Parent Trap? Some of you don't. Some of you maybe do. From, I think, 1961 is when it came out, if I recall correctly. But the storyline of that Disney movie Parent Trap is where these two identical twin girls as teenagers in the original film, they were at summer camp. And they didn't know that they were sisters, but they meet each other at summer camp. What had happened was their parents, when they were just after they were born, had separated and divorced, and each got one of the twin girls. Obviously, the girls didn't know it, identical twins. But here they are at the same summer camp, and they meet one another, and they begin talking and realize what's happened once they talk things out and they see how identical they look. And then what they do is they cut their hair the same, and they say, well, it'd be fun to see what the other parent is like. So the one that's been only with the mother and the one that's been only with the father says, let's switch places. So they cut their hair to look exactly alike and talked about how they behave and all the rest, and then they switch places, and then the movie goes from there. With all of the confusion, though, see, that's involved when people look exactly alike. There's great confusion. It's part of the wisdom of God to say, I'm different. And you're different. You're unique. We have very unique facial features. Huh? Everything about us. With genetics, there's similarities with our parents, yes. But we're different. Charnock says this, man, like to all the rest of the world, yet unlike to any, and differentiated by some mark from all, which is not to be observed in any other species of creatures. Unquote. I'll read it again. Man, like to all the rest of the world, yet unlike to any, and differenced by some mark from all, which is not to be observed in any other species of creatures, unquote. For the preservation of human society and order in the world. We have order. All of a sudden I look and I go, I know, that's Leander. Rather than all of the Bengal tigers looking alike, you know. You're like, I don't know which one's Fred or which one's Jill or Smith, or I have no idea, you know. Part of the wisdom of God. The order and preservation of society. Interesting observation by Charnock. So, thinking about praising God, considering His works of creation, creating us body and soul in His image. Next time we meet, Lord willing, we'll ponder the soul and how that witnesses, the human soul witnesses that there is a God who exists.